So hi everybody, and welcome along to Wednesday evening. And just as Deborah said, we're doing presenting the path and we're doing the review. Before we do that, of course, we'll take refuge together, generate a mind of enlightenment, and say the preliminary prayers. So please get comfortable in your seat. Ideally, your back will be straight, your feet will be flat on the floor or cushion. Your shoulders are going to relax. Check to see if your head is evenly balanced on your neck. And if you like, you can begin to close your eyes or just keep them partially open. And now let your body breathe itself. And with the body breathing itself, imagine that in the space in front of you, just about the level of your eyebrows, is a golden throne, and sitting on it is Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he's wearing the three robes, or fully ordained monk. Shakyamuni Buddha is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and other meditational deities. You yourself are surrounded by all sentient beings. So think that your father is beside you on the right and your mother on the left. Friends and family are sitting behind you. Difficult people are directly in front of you, and then these groups of people are surrounded by a multitude of strangers. And everyone is facing the Buddha and his entourage. You recollect that everyone has an equal wish to avoid suffering, equally wishes to be happy, and equally lacks genuine happiness. Genuine happiness can be realized, can be actualized by removing whatever hinders that. These hindrances, which are causes of suffering, can be eliminated. And again, the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. Now, to dispel the causes of suffering and to actualize genuine happiness, we have to abandon different forms of attachment. We need to abandon attachment to the fantasies we have about this life, but to all the pleasures of psychic existence, to our own singular welfare, and to the belief in an independent and objective reality. I want you to acknowledge these possibilities of abandonment, then decide to abandon these obstacles, and bring about your own welfare and the welfare of everyone else. So accomplish total freedom from the obscurations to bring about the sense of abandonment and the adoption of all good qualities. Decide to depend upon the Buddha, the teachings of his called the Dharma, and his spiritual community. To affirm this safe direction you're going to put into your life, join me in saying, I go for refuge as I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendment. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendment. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendment. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. that in response to this wish of ours, imagine that lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. And these streams of light and nectar remove every obstacle to your spiritual path. Every hindrance is completely washed away. And the potential for full awakening is actualized. So you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. And to affirm this, please join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, imagine that lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These wash over yourself and all sentient beings surrounding you, and every obstacle and hindrance to your spiritual development is removed entirely. Now take a moment to recollect that the field of merit is above us, and prepare yourself to purify the mind and to accumulate even greater merit and to increase that merit. So join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And stop us from clinging to the merit that we've accumulated and the practices of purification we've done. Recollect emptiness. There are no phenomena that exist independently. Whatever does exist, does so dependently, and in particular upon consciousness and naming. So acknowledging that your body, your mind, your speech, every sense object in the universe has no true existence. Transform all of it into a wonderful, pure land that you're now prepared to offer to the field of merit above you. You say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, the dawn of Mount Meru, four continents, southern England. I imagine this as a broader field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So you release this offering and the Buddha accepts it and he smiles at you. And you look up into the gaze of the Buddha and feel accepted and at ease, knowing that whatever you wish for, you can accomplish it with the help of these enlightened beings. Now, an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide with the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And the emanation now begins to descend down through the scalp, down through the throat, into your chest, and it stops at the level of your heart. Whereby this emanation now begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectars. And these pour out through the pores of the skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And now you can hear the sound of Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra resounding through space. And you begin to join in. Saying, Tayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Sama. Tayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Sama. Now the light rays begin to return from the 10 directions of space, we enter your heart. You feel the seat beneath you, you hear the sound of traffic. And you know that this meditation is one of imagination. But the process of imagination has imprinted the mind with conditions for your full awakening. So I think that your awakening depends upon your skills with study and reflection and meditation. And what we're doing this evening is applying these three skills to the path to enlightenment. And again, just affirm that you're studying this path to bring about enlightenment for yourself and all and every living being. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth, and let your eyes flutter open, and move your shoulders, your hands, your body, whichever way you'd like to become comfortable once again. So Deborah said at the beginning, and so did I, so this is a review of what we've covered. The topic, of course, is the Buddhist path to enlightenment. So we began by looking at Buddhist history, and we moved on to Atisha's lamp, being the foundation for all the Lamrim texts. We looked at the 12 deeds, which are not a biography of the Buddha, but a hagiography, a teaching aid. We looked at some of the benefits and faults of listening. And in brief, we covered the three principal aspects of the path and the three capacities of the spiritual practitioner. Those are small, middling, and a great capacity. So we sort of going into the details of this material. Again, these are some of the books that I've relied upon. I put these up here because they've got commentaries on the three principal aspects of the path, the foundation of all good qualities, and there might even be another text in there as well that they comment on. So again, we're doing a review of the eight Buddhist teachings. So as you know, this the path to enlightenment, at least in this presentation of all the texts, comes from one specific text. And that text was called The Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. It has 68 verses in it, and it was written by this amazing practitioner whose birthday is still celebrated in India today, called Atisha Srinana. Now, this text came about because Atisha was sort of allowed to go to Tibet and teach, but he had to return back to India. He was India's greatest scholar at the time. So he taught in Tibet and he was making his way back to India, and he was stopped from getting there because there was a war in Nepal, so he couldn't cross. So to make up for this inability to carry out his promise, he composed this text and said, I'll take this with you. It's send it back to India. And the Indian scholars were so impressed and so grateful. And it, like, this is worth it's worth you staying there. We've got the dynamite in our hands. Yeah. And so, yeah, so this was created in Western Tibet at the Tolling Temple, which still does exist. There's a picture in the background there. And it was probably about the middle 11th century. Do you remember when you first got the English translations of the Lamrim Chigwin? Any idea? What's it now? The idea, Chris?
Yeah.
2008? Yeah. Anyway, so you know, we now have the copies, we've got English copies of Lamp from the Path, and some of all the different Lamrims. We've got a lot of Lamrim texts in our library. When we look at the Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation, the great stages of the path to enlightenment. So Lama Tsongkhapa presented a number of different Lamrim texts. So Lamrim just means stages of a path. Lamrim, steps of the path to enlightenment, or stages, a graduated process. So when you look at his great Lamrim. So he was presented a number that's got one very large one, one a bit smaller, and then one very small. And then we've got Foundation of All Good Qualities and
Songs of Experience.
Songs of Experience and Three Principal Aspects. These, you know, ones we have in the library, we could probably find them pretty easily. When he presents the great, the big one, he's got this special way of doing it. He starts off talking about the greatness of the author and the greatness of the teaching. And then he tells them how to listen to and explain the teachings. So you get this as a preliminary before the text actually opens up. So the greatness of the author is presented first, then the greatness of the teaching, and we finish up with how to listen to and explain the teaching. So I put this up as a question in the exam. You know, this is one of these three preliminaries. And so here's your answer. Yes, it does. Yeah. And so even though this text was written by Lama Tsongkhapa, he said, you know, the great teacher, of course, is Lama Ratisha, because this teaching that I'll present to you comes from the Lamp for the Path. So he's sort of saying, actually, Lama Ratisha is the author of this text. And then, of course, then it goes into the greatness of the teaching itself and why it's so great, what it can do for you. And finally, just how to listen to and explain the teachings. And within the section, how to listen to and explain the teachings, they talk about wrong ways of listening and correct ways of listening. And the wrong way of listening is use the simile of the three cups. So they say, don't, when you go to teaching, don't listen like a cup upside down. So that means that whatever I'm saying, for instance, I'm talking to you, like nothing goes in. And that's, that can take place because maybe you're really distressed or you're thinking about other things while you're sitting here, so you miss a great deal. It's happened before, people are like, what was that about? That sort of thing happens. So don't listen like an upside down cup. The other one is don't listen like a dirty cup. So I've heard different explanations for this, but one of them is to bring into it wrong types of motivation. Like, so when I asked about whether I was sort of fit enough to sit up here and give teachings, the guest said about this, you always teach to try to help somebody. You're teaching out of kindness, not to make money or to be thought of as a, you know, great guy. There's always this, so you can make sure your motivation is right. For me to teach. But from your guys, I was like, you have to make sure your motivation is also correct. So that's why we always start off saying, affirming again and again, you're doing this to become enlightened, to help everybody else. It's always try and check that this is your motivation. Now, many teachers say it's time to refresh our motivation. Like you know, the great Tibetan teachers you see up here, that's what they're saying, refresh, refresh the motivation. That's the way of saying, remind yourself what you're doing and why you're doing it. Now, the other thing Kitsa Rupa says to you about the sturdy cup, he said, Eddie, you're going to find people who come in here just to disagree with you, to prove you wrong, and to argue with you. So he says, so when that happens, you'll be very patient with them. You know, but this is like this empty cup idea. And the other one is, don't listen like a cup that has a hole in it or a crack in it. What this demonstrates, as you can see here, the tea is being poured in, but it's poured out, it's running away. So it's saying here, when you listen to teachings, don't let them just go in one ear and out the other. I mean, it's not an easy thing to prevent, because sometimes, like tonight, there's so much information. So many times teachers also say, take something away that you can hang on to. But these are the three wrong ways of listening, and then they tell you about the six ways that can help you correctly listen. And these are to always perceive yourself as a patient, meaning that you're unwell, you're sick. Then when you come here to the center, it's like you're coming to the hospital. And what you want, of course, is some medicine to cure your sickness. So you come in and you say, look at your teacher as if they were a doctor of the mind or the doctor of the heart. So look at it like that. And then the teachings themselves are the medicine. Again, a little story. So I remember one time Kensa Rinpoche came to the teachings, of course, to give us a teaching. And something happened where it became obvious to Geshe that none of the students were coming there because he was there. And he took exception to this. And said, you do not come to the center because it's me. You become for the Dharma. You know, you come for the medicine. I'm just the doctor who gives you the medicine. You're here to get well. What makes you well is taking the medicine. So again, I always remember some of these little things. You know, often when he does this, he's quite wrathful. You know, he's not very firm. So it's not like you're going to forget it in a hurry. And then, like I said, serious practice is a cure for the illness. Now, these are the four most important of the six. But the fifth one is perceive the Buddha himself as a holy being, and finally produce the wish that the Dharma will endure for a long, long time. Now, this last wish, this will come to you naturally after you've been here for a few years and you understand, oh my gosh, this is a wonderful medicine. You know? So you don't ever want it to go out of existence. So after this topic of how to listen to and explain the teachings, then there's often the topic on how to rely upon a teacher comes up, and then the actual lambdom sort of starts. And what it starts with is the teachings on death and impermanence. And so our teacher puts up three major points about death, and each of these major points has three other little points to support the major point. So the three major points are that death is certain. No one escapes. It's that film of Natural Born Killers. You know, when she was in the cell, she said, no one gets out of here alive. No one escapes. That's right, no escape. So death is certain. Some people say taxes are too, but I disagree. And this is the other thing, the time of death is uncertain. Most people don't know when they're going to die. Of course, hardly realize people can. I've read many stories of people lying in their bed and going, you know, I'm about to die, or and so forth. But in general, no one knows when they're going to die or sort of how. And then at the time of death, only the practice of Dharma will help you. Like I said, so they go through the different, each of these has three supporting roles, and then there are three determinations. So can anybody remember what the first thing is when they say that death is certain? If you know that death is certain, what must you do?
Take refuge in
practice Dharma.
Practice Dharma. Must practice Dharma. If you know when death is certain, you can't escape it, practice Dharma. Okay. The time of death is uncertain, what should you do then?
Practice
it
now.
Yes. That's right. Practice it right now. That's right. And finally, the last point is to take that from one is practice the pure Dharma right now. So the Dharma you practice right now, make sure it's pure. That's like this thing about the daily cup, right? Make sure you're doing this. Your death is taking place because you wish to become fully enlightened to help others. So even though death is taking place, I wish to become fully awakened to benefit others. And then you can learn, you can do anything else after that, but you know, start a priori. After this topic of impermanence and death, it follows on to, about the sufferings of the lower realms. Because of course, after you die, your awareness or your mental stream goes somewhere or experiences something. And it can experience either really terrible things or something much better. So in this part of the labyrinth, they talk about the terrible things. So then the idea, of course, is like, why would you do that? Right? And the answer is to know what to expect, thereby take measures to avoid it. So the best measure you can take, of course, is to practice the pure Dharma. This is the mind of enlightenment. But there are many different things you can practice here. So sometimes I say, like if you have a really good relationship with a teacher and you really appreciate it, then think of your teacher. That's a virtuous one. See your teacher as a living Buddha. That's a good way to die. But to think of your parents' kindness or any object of kindness is also a good way to die. So you'll know as you go through these teachings, there are many different types of virtues you can create. Now you can be compassionate, you can be kind, you can have devotion. No matter any, just do any of them, because that will help you avoid the lower realms. You want to die with that sort of positive mental state. Then there's a question arises about how are the lower realms or the sufferings of the lower realms related to the practice of refuge? Because after this topic of the lower realms, you get a topic called refuge in the three jewels. So that topic is brought up as associated with the lower realms, because this is one of the principal causes of taking refuge. It's the idea that you want to be afraid of something terrible and then protect yourself from it. So the way you protect yourself from it is you take refuge. And like I said, there's many objects of refuge. There's Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. If you're doing the Dharma, then you have love, compassion, devotion, lots of different mental states you can create. So you want to have a state of mind that is terrified of the sufferings of the lower realms, so that you really, you know, that's not going to happen to me. You know, why? Because I've done this, and it's impossible if you've done this to get that. It's like the idea they talk about in karma, right? What's the major rule of karma, karma cause and effect? That's right, so I give an example of it. Karma is between cause and effect. Yeah, so it sort of says that virtues lead to happiness in this life and in future lives. Non-virtue leads to suffering in this life and other lives. So this is the correspondence. Bad action, bad result. Good action, good result. So you go here, well, you know, you're not doing any bad stuff. So that's one thing. So that stops the effect of finding yourself in the lower realms. That's the idea. You look at the lower realms and you go, yeah, well, how do I get there? You go, well, create negative behaviors. That'll help. And if you do, that's the effect, right? And you think, okay, at the time of my death, my mind is negative. This is the effect, the lower realms. It's really straightforward. If it's positive, can't be. So, yeah, okay, I know that. I want to make sure at the time of my death, as long as I'm thinking, it's positive. This is why this intention is so important. And why was the intention is karma? And so to think that there's lots of ways to think about death that is really powerful. And if you find some of those that really resonate with you, then I want to keep that sort of thing. Make your death meaningful, especially for those around you. In fact, I remember a story that Green Mullen told us in one of his books, where they were teaching, and this teacher said, "I've got a special teaching tonight. Really special. I want you to all come along if you can." No? Ooh, no, oh, great. Must be something really great. So they go along, and he starts to die in front of them.
Oh my
That's the special teaching.
God.
Yeah. And then everyone sort of jumped up, and he's like, "What to do? What to do?" He's sort of like looking at them, "Are you sure? Are you sure you want to be there?" Anyway, they got the ambulance and all these sort of things, right? I just want to show you how a real good practitioner can die. Anyway,
Did he die?
not there, no, they carted him off and brought him back and everything. But if you look at that and you look at your own life, and think, okay, how would you like to, if there are people around you who care for you, what's the best lesson you can give to them at this time? You're dying, huh? Give them a lesson on how to die. The best lesson you can give them. Because most people are afraid, aren't they? They don't know what to do. Try to put their mind at ease. In fact, I heard of a woman who passed a few years ago, not a Dharma practitioner, but she was taken to the hospice. And I heard she invited everybody in, and there was a lot of people who behaved quite badly to her, and she wanted them to all come in so she could wish them well and send them on. Yeah, she's an Irish woman, Catholic, but she had this really, well, found out about the different things she does. That's a Dharma practitioner. It doesn't matter whether it's Christianity or whatever. This is, person practicing. Good on it. And this what we can all do that too. It's our party. All the guests might think they're in charge and go, "Hang on, put your hand up and let them know. Hey, I'm the one dying here. Just keep it down." And as you know, as Buddhist practitioners, if you read many of Lama's opus texts, you're often thinking of like quieting everything down. Be very respectful to the person who's passing, and you do as much as you possibly can to help them. But the other good thing is once you become sort of familiar with some of the different Buddhist practices, you can apply it to sort of any situation. You can walk in a Christian dharma or Muslim dharma. You know what to do. Moving on from refuge, we move into the teachings of karma. And so karma means what? Anyone? Karma is
action.
Action. That's right. The karmas are like actions, but there's a particular, and the action is the cause. So there's many ways of looking at actions, but you can look at the actions from the point of view of the effect, but that's not karma. It's from the point of view of cause. So every action of body, speech, or mind produces a result. So that's also seen as karma, but that's the effect, right? Like I said, the major thing here is the cause. The greatest cause in terms of virtue is the mind seeking enlightenment for the benefit of others. And of course, if this is authentic, wonderful. But maybe it's not, maybe it takes a lot of work for us to get ready and we're dying and we don't have that mind of enlightenment. Then, like I said, pick any other object of virtue. If it's your teacher or even your mother's kindness, it doesn't really matter. You need to have an object of virtue here. Well, the action is the, this is the thing, the action here we're talking about is intention, the cause. Yeah, it's not what comes after.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah. But like I said, you hear every action a result. That's also called karma. But what you should remember is you say this is the result of karma. Don't just call it karma. There's lots of people do, and then you're going to get, oh my gosh, hang on a minute. So it's often you use the proper language. Like, this is the effect of karma. This is called karma. It's actually the effect of karma. Now, not only is karma these cause and effect, but it's also imprint. So once the action is committed, we've finished the action. Now it leaves what they call the seed or imprints the mind with the potential to bring about its effect. Just, you know, like, as you know, they often use the example of you know, seeds in terms of agriculture. So we've got this seed, and you know, so we've got an agricultural phenomenon called a seed. The Buddhists have got a phenomenon called a seed too, and what it is an action that's been completed. It's finished. So they call it a seed. What is that seed? It's a potential to produce an effect. Just like this seed has the potential to produce a plant. But in both cases, those seeds need help. They need conditions. So the conditions for the agricultural seed are things like?
Well, sunlight,
sunlight,
water.
Earth, water, moisture, all those sort of things. Yep, okay. And without them, that seed could never grow and flourish. Right? In terms of the mind, and this action is karma now, yeah? It's a karma, it's a seed, it can produce an effect too. What does it need? It needs conditions, doesn't it? What are the conditions? You want to know?
Afflictive emotion.
That's right, the afflictive emotion. That's what it needs, craving, grasping. With that, she's off, you're off at money. And what happens is these seeds, these potentials, they arise independent upon feeling. And then the feeling, then the craving and the grasping come in, and oh, we're off. Here we go, this law that karma refers to. All sufferings are the result of unwholesome actions. So likewise are all bad rebirths. The pleasure enjoyed throughout our lives of all happy rebirths are the result of virtue. So again, so you look at, okay, so you imagine I'm about to die. So you know, this gonna, you know that, okay, so some sort of effect is going to take place, isn't it? You go like, well, what sort of effect would you like to take place? Would you like suffering or not suffering? Yeah. And so, you know, okay, the suffering is going to take place. Well, I've got the potential for both. They're just waiting on the motion. Now, so what conditions are needed to produce the happiness? Well, virtuous minds. Minds associated with goodness. You want the other side. Have this craving and grasping associated with negative stuff. So, you know, at our level, in terms of our capacities and capabilities, and in a way, I'm just talking about myself, really, because I don't know. That goes. Like, I know I've done a whole lot of stupid things in my life in this life, right? So I'm probably in other lives too. But I know I've also escaped the consequences of my silly behaviour in this life. Lots of them. I haven't experienced the bad outcomes that should have taken place, right? So then I know, okay, that doesn't mean to say I got off scot-free. It means just that the police haven't caught up with me yet. But that stuff that I did, that's all sitting there waiting for its consequence to take place. So then you're going to go, okay, when's that going to happen? Yeah, well, it could take place the next one, it could take place in the Bardo, or it could take place in a further life, in some other life. Man, I don't want it to take place at all. I want to have the same run of good luck that I've had in this one. So I've got to do something. And then I've got to sort of stop it taking place. And of course, that's what we find all these different practices where we can do that. Yeah, so this is really important. In fact, what I like to do sometimes is look at some of the Sangha members, Western Sangha members who've been practicing Dharma for 30, 40 years, and see what they say are the most important practices. So what I find is people say different things. But I do remember once seeing in the FPMT one of the Western Dharma students, monks from, I think this teachers in Adelaide there, but for him it was karma, cause and effect. And then if anyone would be there, she's really good on this. This is her talks, this is where she is. And you go, well, you know, when you read the text, remember, you become a follower, a legitimate follower of the Buddha when you adopt the teachings of cause and effect. So you know, there's like refuge in karma. Like, okay, so refuge has stopped me taking the lower round rebirth, but how? By behaving in accordance with the teachings of cause and effect. And you know, the best thing you can remember about cause and effect is this verse here. Bad behaviors lead to bad outcomes. Good behaviors lead to good outcomes. That's what you've got to get your head around, and then you work out what are the bad behaviors, what are the good behaviors. And then over time, stop doing the bad, do more of the good. So by the time you do come to Dharma, your mind is so familiar with the good, it's hardly likely to go into the bad side. Then I asked us, for me and for you guys too, to look at one of these karmas, one of the actions, and say, well, what are the different effects that take place? So I'm going to take the action of killing. So here, Lama Zopa is a term that I don't see a lot of, but it's called the possessed result. And what this possessed result is talking about is like, so, because normally the result is, if you've not put into place anything that's going to stop that bad outcome, you're going to find yourself in the lower realms, right? But suppose you do have something in place, and you don't find yourself in the lower realms, you find yourself reborn as a human being once again. Great. Good result, right? However, in this one, you meet many dangers. Right? So, luckily we aren't. But you know, plenty of places around the world where the dangers are horrific, aren't they? So this is sort of saying, okay, you've accomplished rebirth as a human being, terrific. However, you find yourself in a place where your life is threatened. What with? You know, you might say, well, this environment you find yourself in is like full of strife. And so, because you've killed in the past, your experience in this life could be a short life. You took the life of somebody else, you shortened their life. Your experience as a human being is to find your environment dangerous and your life finishes early. Or this could happen. The possessed result is you're a human being. Perhaps the environment is not so full of strife and you haven't experienced the short life. However, you are killing. And we see that, don't we? We know stories of this. Some of us have heard those terrible, tragic stories about young children who murdered other children. And you're like, wow, where'd that come from? So this is, for example, karma cause and effect. You can put it down to karma. We also find, as you know, many children who like to kill insects and animals. And then they move up, don't they? Then they go into harming human beings, and later on they turn out to be murderers. So this is the experience, the behavioral effect of killing in some other lifetime, and then you experience this effect as a human being. But the good news is you can stop it all taking place. And this is through the practice of what we call our purification. So here we have, so to stop experiences like the cause. So when we looked at this, what were the experiences like the cause? The short life. So, instead of having a short life, we don't want to have that, we want to stop that. What do we have to do? Have remorse for the actual karmas that you have done. The throwing karma that's actually put us into the human realm, this is the remedies. So, like we said, the normally throwing karmas will chuck you into a lower realm of rebirth. But because you've decided, I'm not doing it, now I know what's going to happen to me, I'm stopping killing, I'm not going to do it anymore. So and that, how does that happen? Through remorse. How to stop it? Through the remedies. We ought to stop behaviours like the cause, like this killing. You just resolve, I will not kill again. So, we stop killing. And then just to find yourself, to escape rebirth in the lower realms and find yourself in the higher realms, especially as a human being, in a good environment, you take refuge and generate the mind of enlightenment. So each of those four opponents, you can see is that like we take reliance, we rely upon the three jewels and the mind of enlightenment. We resolve, we decide not to do these sort of behaviors again. And the fact is, you know, I know I hurt others, so what can I do that might be of benefit to them? And as you know, there's lots of different things you can do, many, many different remedies. But it all depends upon remorse. Without remorse, none of this works. So the remorse here is not aimed at the other, it's aimed at your future suffering. But once you look at karma, cause and effect, and you see, oh, look, okay, yeah, I did kill this animal or insect or something like that, and I'm delighted in it. You know, you look through and you go, was it a complete action? You go, mostly they are. Negative actions are then always complete, and the good are hardly ever complete. So yeah, we can go through this and see how each part of the opponent opposes one part of the action. Because actions are made up of parts too. Now, so here we can see that we're using the four opponents. We're trying to stop different forms of suffering that take place. And there are different ways of talking about suffering. One way of talking about them is you can talk about the suffering of suffering, or the dukkha of suffering, the suffering of change, or the dukkha of change, and the dukkha of all pervasive conditioning. So here, what the dukkha of change is that the fact that whatever we place our mind, whatever our senses are light upon, are subject to change. So these sense objects and the happiness that's produced by our dependence upon them or engagement with them changes. So they're not, it's not reliable. So this is what we need to look at ourselves. So we all want to be happy. What are we doing to be happy? What are we relying upon? Look at those objects and see if they're subject to change. Because if they are, then your mind is subject to change too. So sort of say, look, these objects are not reliable objects to put your faith into if you wish to have a long-term stable happiness. They can't produce that. But why is subject to change? So when we see that these are what we call samsaric objects or the objects of the senses are not reliable in terms of long-term stable happiness. You gotta look at it and go like, well, what can I depend upon then? If these objects are not reliable upon. So you find out what you can depend upon, which is in fact general, the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, when you see that you can't rely upon these ordinary objects, mundane objects, you also realize that although I can't rely upon them, I keep relying on them. it's really difficult to break that habit. So it takes a long time and quite a bit of study to see, like, there's no way that these objects can give you what you actually want. That's the sort of idea that you've got to get into your mind, right? No matter, then these objects just can't do it. This brings up this sort of what we call renunciation. So you have a renunciation towards these objects that are unreliable. You know, you give up, basically. The renunciation. So there's a definite wish which arises once you see the faults and shortcomings of psychic existence. Then you generate a really strong wish to abandon and find this liberated state. Again, what you'll find is there's no object of your senses you can rely upon. So what's left? Yeah, interest depends upon something.
The mind.
Yeah, the mind. That's what's left. So obviously the mind can create samsara or can create nirvana or can act realize nirvana, not create it, it realizes it. So we have this choice, right? And this is what I like what His Holiness saying. He asked this question on some, what's the source of suffering? And so he said, the mind. You know, he said, it's the undisciplined mind that creates your samsara. But the mind disciplined reveals nirvana. So this discipline, there's a number of different aspects to it. One of them is the discipline to keep your senses away from those sense objects, right? Because what often happens is craving and grasping will arise. However, you've got to remember that this is just what we're talking about here about teaching shared with those of small and medium scope. Because once you take on the bodhisattva path, you can actually use all those objects of the senses skillfully. If you didn't know about the mind of enlightenment, about the wisdom realizing emptiness, then you just got to create a strong wish to stay away from these objects. The pleasure of running arises in defense of how running, right? So you know, if you stop running, what's going to happen?
Yes, stop feeling happy.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, okay, it's not so great. However, what you could do is bring to it the mind of enlightenment, right? Because that's the major action. This other thing is just comes along with it. So say, through running, you know, may I do blah, blah, blah. And then now it becomes, you know, it's not mundane because it's conjoined with the mind wishing to bring about enlightenment for all beings. But again, just saying this might seem like, great, right? But it doesn't work like that. You've actually got to have an actual mind of enlightenment, right? It's got to be like spontaneous and natural. So you wish that and then you run. And then beauty. But until that comes, you just make the wish. Right? And then you keep training until it's actualized. But, you know, you've got to be running to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. Right? So I know there are actual musicians that go up on stage and play and make this all the music and offering to all the sentient beings, bringing the joy, may this joy act as a cause for them to actualize their mind.
That's the speech blessing.
Yeah, so it is a speech blessing. And often you'll do the daily practice of Tara, and you go on stage, and away you go. And it makes it so easy to accomplish a lot of those actions you often find hard. Look, I, before I came here, for some time while I was here, I feel really embarrassed about reciting the Shakyamuni Buddha mantra, right? Because I know I'm a terrible, I think. I have a very bad voice. I can't sing it true. I'm often flat. And like, I'd never do this unless it's for this course. So I don't care what it sounds like. I think, no, the most important thing is why I'm doing it. And so they gave me, I was doing that. And it was the same thing here when I first came to teach. I had a very bad stammer and stutter. I couldn't talk like this. And what I used to do, was just, I could talk like this when it came to meditating. I'd go, no, I can't do that. Then his mother said, let the deity do it. It's like, oh, that's right. So then, you know, the self-generation practice, it's not me. It's coming out of Tara, and it's for all sentient beings to bring us all to enlightenment. It's very simple and easy like that. You take the pressure off yourself, you know. And you know David is no peer pressure, right? They don't have any problems like I do. So it just makes it easier to get on with things. Okay, I think it's time for our first meditation. So please, adjust the posture. Let's get comfortable in your seat. So let your body rest in a calm and upright way. Drop the shoulders. And if possible, try to release any tight feelings in your face, the jaw, or the shoulders. And now take two deep breaths, one after the other. And again. And say to yourself, I'm doing this meditation practice to bring about enlightenment for every sentient being. And now think of your mind as a clear sky. Worries and concerns are just like clouds passing through the clear sky. And think of these worries and concerns as not being yours. They are not yours. They just arise depending upon the conditions and appear. Now, if we grasp at these clouds of worry, we will suffer. But what would happen if we did not grasp at them, if we did not cling to them? Suffering could not take place. So think about that. If I don't grasp and hold, if I do not believe, then the suffering will not take place. Your life can change. Stop running on the hedonic treadmill. In fact, you can just step off and walk calmly towards your own freedom. This is like somebody who's been in a dark cave for many, many years and is stepping out into sunlight. Now, one of the different types of suffering we can experience is called the suffering of change. So I want you to ask yourself, can anything you own protect you from change? There are many things that you own which are very useful. But can they save you from the changes of life? To depend upon this phenomena, it's like leaning on a rotten stick that will break. So what if we were to stop looking for lasting joy in things that break? What if we stop doing that? Perhaps you might find a sort of calm and stable quiet strength. It's very much like mountains are, you know, when the storms come, the mountain just stays basically still and stable. This is the type of mind we wish to develop. A stable mind resting on virtue. So recollect the deepest truth, this truth about karma, law of karma. And then decide to act that way. Look at your actions before, look at actions before you act. Ask yourself, is this the cause? Will this action bring about happiness or suffering? Once you determine which one will be, you will know how to act. So may your actions that you choose bring about a true and lasting, stable state of happiness. And breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. So now we're sort of moving into the practices of the persons of great capacity. And one of the questions, you know, these people, to develop a mind that wishes to attain enlightenment, to have this mind become spontaneous and natural, requires a lot of different practices. And one of the first types of practice you can do is the practice of equanimity. So here we just got this question, what it is. Right? It's an unbiased mental state, often called impartiality or being impartial. Why it's so good for, it sort of forms the basis for the latter development of the mind of enlightenment. So what it does, like it stops the attachment that we have towards friends, the animosity or enmity that we have towards people we might call our enemies, and it stops the indifference towards strangers. Now, if any of those mental states are there, our anger, greed, attachment, or indifference, there's no way to develop the mind of enlightenment. It's impossible. And so that's the first thing, just get the mind sort of settled by seeing there's no actual real difference between friends and enemies and strangers. You know, as we know, they're interchangeable over time, aren't they? And nobody, yeah, so we know this. Right? Now, there's a great need to develop this, and again, we can look at it through the different scopes or different capacities. So for the person who first begins, you just start with a wish, right? You don't, you know, develop this. Have this wish, you think about it, wow, wouldn't it be great if this actually took place? I wish it would. But we also know that that's great having a wish, but unless you do something, it's not going to actually take place, right? So that leads us to the middle scope, where we do something. We overcome our own attachment and anger and indifference. Once we start with a wish, then we do it. In the great scope, this helps us overcome favoritism when directing our love and compassion towards others. Now, this type of equanimity is the precursor to a practice called the seven cause and effect instruction. And this is one of the ways of developing the mind of enlightenment, one of the major ways of developing the mind of enlightenment. And in that practice, you start with this equanimity, so you get everything nice and even. Then you look at that and say, if the mind is beginningless and endless, as it's presented in the text, you sort of work it through that must have no beginning. So it's beginningless. This means you've taken rebirth again and again and again and again. Dinner festival. Oh, I must have had a mother. Yeah, not many of those rebirths. And so this is this thing that I can now consider all sentient beings as having been your mother over countless lifetimes. And just the fact that they give birth to you should look at that as an act of kindness. So it doesn't require you to say, was my mother kind? Did she give birth to me or not? It don't matter. It's just the fact you were born is an act of kindness. Because everything that good happened to you after that was because you got born. Yeah, that was because of my mother. So my mother's, I recall her kindness. All of that. Yeah, you can look at that. You go right into the detail of how so much of the body itself of the mother becomes a nutrient for the child, doesn't it? And then all the difficulties he's got to go through and all these sort of things. So it's really looking at the this process of holding the child in the womb and then bringing him into this world. But then you'll also see that even when your mum has brought you into this world, that they feed you, they put the clothes on you. It just goes on and on and on. In fact, the Buddha says you cannot repay the kindness of your parents. It's impossible to do So we've got to begin to recall their kindness. And then, even though it's impossible, we have to repay the kindness. Right? They say, well, what does mum really want? Well, what does my dad really want? What would be the best thing I could give to them? So out of this comes a sense of, from our side, love and kindness. And then this great compassion. Now, of course, we do this in repaying kindness. It doesn't take you much to think, well, of course, I could buy a car and a house and all this. Of course, great, if you can do that, do that. But as you already know, about change, you go, gosh, actually, what if the house burnt down? You think of all sorts of things where, of course, they're nice objects to give them, but could I do any better? What does she really want? And you'd probably find out what she'd really like is to be happy and have a real stable happiness. And on the other side, to not suffer. And you find it's not just her, it's many, all these other people who have all been our mothers. And so we think, okay, I've got to do this. I've got to try and help my mothers. Not suffer needlessly and develop whatever it is that it takes to become fully awakened. But you've got to remember, most of your parents don't know about this stuff, do they? No, it's us, right? So nevertheless, we have this wholehearted resolve to help them. And in here, you've got to have this thing, you want to help. But there's a second part that comes and goes, but it's impossible. I can't. As I am. But what if I became fully enlightened like the Buddha did, and who's helped me in this life? So I know how to die, I know what state of liberation exists, all these things, I know my happiness can be one that's pure. It's been done before, it's been done today, so therefore I have to become enlightened for his sake. So there you have this mind of enlightenment. In terms of training in this, you do it again and again. And I guess you would say do it forwards and then do it backwards. Use all your reason to go through each step as I did with you guys. You try and do it yourself. Then you get there and go, okay, now how did I get this wish to become enlightened? I had the resolve to do so. And what did that depend upon? Great compassion. What did that depend upon? Like love and kindness. So what did that depend upon? And so you go backwards and forwards. And you just keep running these ideas through your mind. And over time, you'll actually feel this way. This is one of the methods. Now another method, of course, is this one called equalizing exchanging self for others. And it also begins with an equalizing practice, but the equalizing is a little different than the other. The second stage is this, the equalizing self and others here is just this realization that just as I want to be happy, so do you. And that way we have the same wish, so we're equal. Just as I don't want to experience suffering, neither do you. Our wishes are the same, therefore they are equal. I'm not happy. I'm still suffering. So is my mum. So are you. We're the same, then, aren't we? That's it. Just have a bit of equality between yourself and everybody else. We start like that type of equality. And then we go, but yet I cherish myself more than you. Even though we're equal, I think I'm somehow more deserving. So then we look at all the faults of this type of thinking. And on this other side, we go, what would be the benefits of cherishing my mother more than myself? Once we see that there's greater benefit in cherishing others than being egocentric, we change our view. And we end up doing the practice of Tong then called giving and taking. Now, what is this mind called? So what is this mind called bodhicitta? What is Bodhi? What's Bodhi? Anyone?
Awake.
Yeah, awake or enlightenment. And citta is mind. Yeah, that's what we've got, this awake mind or the mind of enlightenment. And as we know, this mind of enlightenment, in brief, is a wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. That's the simplest explanation I can give you. But there's a much more in-depth explanation that you are familiar with. Special mental main mind, which is the entryway to the Mahayana path, and is concomitant with its assisted aspiration that focuses on complete enlightenment for the benefit of others. So it's quite a mouthful, and I've highlighted each of these different words within as an explanation for each of them. Now, of course, there's a couple of minds, obstacles to developing this wish. One is anger. So you cannot have this wish and be angry at sentient beings. So those two work against one another. The other thing that really works against them is what they call self-cherishing. Because this is a mind that cherishes others. Self-cherishing is a mind that cherishes me. Forget about the others. It's also called our self-centeredness and also egocentricity. But when we try to describe what is it, I used to think, I'd ask these questions, is it an afflictive emotion? And the answer is no. What's left, eh? If it's not an afflictive emotion, what's left? Well, it's a cognitive obscuration. Is it one of them? Yeah. No, it's not that either. It's described as an inferior obscuration. It's not actually an obscuration, but it's called one. And it's a problem for those who wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. It's not a problem for those who seek enlightenment for themselves or personal liberation. There is some self-cherishing. Self-cherishing or self-centeredness has three levels. It's gross, and that's bad for everyone. Subtle, and very subtle. So again, it's not the sort of thing that just we've simply explained. If you sort of look into it. And there's quite a bit of explanation of why it's not an actual obscuration and why sometimes it's really bad and sometimes it's nowhere near as bad as that. And this practice of tonglen, also called giving and taking, this is the way of how we develop this mind of enlightenment. We keep practicing compassion and loving kindness on the breath. It's a mental training, of course, designed to reverse the habitual self-centeredness we feel. Now, once we've developed this mind of enlightenment through all of the sevenfold cause and effect, the equal exchange of self and others, or the combination of the two, in this practice of Tonglen, These are all to produce this mind that wishes to attain the level of four sentient beings. So, now, once we have this mind, it's like, okay, I want to attain the level, what do I do? And then the answer is engage in the perfections and the four ways of gathering disciples, even more so be choose to enter the paths of Tantra. But in Sutra, they just say engage in the perfections and the four ways of gathering disciples. That's how you engage in the practice of the mind of enlightenment. Now, these perfections are all based upon like their wishes or aspirations. And they're made up of different parts and there's different ways you can explain them. The first four are the practice of generosity, the perfection of generosity. And like I said, it's the intentional wish to give everything you possibly can to others, whatever they need. So what are some of the things that people need?
Protection.
Protection, yeah.
Food
is a resource. What else?
Dharma.
Excellent. So these are three.
Protection of
Dharma. It acts as an antidote to miserliness for yourself, and it provides resources in the future. And so we definitely need resources. So even though it's not difficult to practice this, yeah, why? Because you only have to wish it. It's mental training. Of course, if you can give resources, protection, dharma, do it. But even if you can't, just to wish to do it. Remember the story you read, the boy who he really wanted to give the Buddha a great present. He knew the Buddha was coming through the town. He had nothing. So what did he do? Went down, picked up a handful of dust and went, I wish this were gold. The whole, and I could give it to you. Never gave him the dust, never turned to gold. But the outcome of that was this really great rebirth and all the good things that happened. So all of these perfections are primarily wishes. That's the most important thing, because that's the action, that's the karma. The wishes and action. But again, if you can actually do it physically, do it. Ethics. This is wish to stop harming others. It's an antidote to lower realm rebirths, and it provides higher realm rebirths. And what are the ethics? Do you remember? The first one was the ethics of not harming others, is it? And of course, the ethics of just helping all sentient beings. Patience. Actually is to just to be calm and undisturbed, or even just to wish that that were the case. Yeah. Another word for patience is forbearance. Like, I wish I could just bear the sufferings that I'm subject to. It's an antidote to anger. It stops the destruction of the roots of virtue. Now, so I see the two major, actually sort of three, I think, that really go against the mind of enlightenment, but anger is the real biggie. Hatred, anger, is the complete opposite of the mind of enlightenment. And, of course, patience stops it. It provides attractiveness and good companions. So this is also really great. I think this oftentimes, if you look at a beautiful man or a woman, you can think, oh, how wonderful they practiced patience so well in past lives. You don't get just hooked up on their looks. Yeah, no, it's the mental stuff. It's just wonderful. Then there's the perfection of joyous perseverance. So the delight in virtuous actions. It's an antidote to jealousy. It completes all virtuous projects. And again, like we know, there's many ways of describing these perfections we're talking about. In fact, Lama put out a book on the six perfections. Again, so you got a whole book on the perfections. So here we've got the perfection of patience, or the perfection of fortitude, and it's this ability to remain resolute and calm in the face of hardship or suffering. So what other ways of being patient are there, or having fortitude in sharing the Dharma is a big one. But, you know, it's not easy to do this, is it? I mean, it's pretty easy for me to talk to you like this. You try this out on one of your children or your parents, you know, you're going to go, my gosh, well, I have to change all my language. You've got to be really careful. You're so patient, they're going to misunderstand. They're going to have all these objections and things. So it requires quite a lot of patience. You have to keep going. This is the other thing Geshe said to me. He said, make sure you know more than students. And, like, keep going. You know, this is, you, like you said, sometimes people come and they don't actually want to hear what you've got to say. They want to prove you wrong. Right? So you've got to be able to sort of bear it. and sort of keep going and not scowl. For me, I'm not the scowl. Now, of course, there are. We looked at four perfections. There are two others called the perfection of concentration. And again, there are three types. You can see mundane, supramundane, and concentrations that benefit others. Supramundane concentrations are concentrations which are combined with a wisdom realized in intimacy. They get you out of cyclic existence, whereas the mundane ones, they're great, but you still stay in cyclic existence. In wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, we have wisdom realized in the ultimate truth, emptiness of inherent existence. The conventional truth, which I often talk about the five subjects of learning. See, what was it about art, medicine, creating all the Dharma, the mandalas, and all that sort of thing. There's many different things. And in terms of dependent arising, there are a number of different types. There are different ways of explaining it. We have arising through meeting. Does anyone remember what that meant? Ben, do you remember? This is cause and effect. Right? Arising through meeting. Causes and conditions produce effects. Then we have existing and reliance. And this one means existing depending upon the parts. Dependent existence is really talking here about how phenomena exist depends upon an awareness or a consciousness and language, the labeling. You can also talk about the phenomena existing depends upon a basis for designation and an imputation. Like, for instance, the basis for designating clock is what? Yeah, something like this white plastic thing I see in front of me, right? You've got the time, there's the function, I call that a clock. Yeah, so there's the two phenomena. The name depends upon this basis of designation. The other way of explaining dependent arising is what they call a causal dependence, which is again as causes produce their effects by relying upon conditions. They depend upon conditions. And then we have this phenomena called dependent designation, which is two parts. Mutual dependence, which Ben mentioned. So Ben, give me an example of mutual dependence.
Light and dark.
Light and dark. It's like self and other, here and there, this bank and that bank, you and I, and so forth. There's many long and short, etc. And then we come back down to this mere dependent designation. So again, it's that same sort of thing where, let me see if I can find. So this means the phenomena exists by being merely named. It's the same explanation as this dependent existence up the top. So the phenomena depend the basis for designating and the name. Well, yeah, you can't just have a name and go on there, is there? You need the other thing.
And that needs a name too.
That's right. Yeah. So this is where, in fact, I remember many in the early 1900s, I think it was Bertrand Russell gave a teaching, and in it he said, he gave us an example, he said, you know, the world sits on a tortoise. And then this woman talked to him and said, and what's the tortoise standing on? And he said, it's tortoises all the way down, my dear. And then I thought, I remember the numbers, it's the names all the way down.
Yeah.
Now, it's actually, this really helps. Dependent arising is tremendous to realize emptiness. Because if you realize, if you understand that things dependently arise, they cannot arise without dependence or independently. Those are mutually exclusive, aren't they? If you've got something that's dependent and something that's not dependent, well, they're very different. They cannot be the same thing. So using dependent arising can lead you to the understanding of emptiness. But if you come at one using emptiness first, it's like emptiness of what? What's empty? It must be like something. Like, you know, you can have a person that's empty, you have a room that's empty. What, if you have an object, what's it empty of? This thing that we're looking for that's empty of is called the object of negation. The thing is, like, how do you find it? And so I give this example of, well, how do you find a thief? You know, like, you can't find the thief unless you can identify it. And so, yeah, like, the thief looks like this. Now we can go, oh, okay, we, yeah, we can have a good look for him and see where he is. So with emptiness, what we want to find is not emptiness, but its opposite, inherent existence. So it's like this phenomenon. You go, well, what would that be? So, well, it's got to be something that seems to exist without depending upon anything whatsoever. It says in the text, and this, they recommend, Lama Tsongkhapa recommends, if you want to find this object, the easiest place to look for is within yourself, within your body and mind. Look at whether your sense of self or personal identity appears to inherently exist. And you go, well, how am I going to do that? You know, and you go, frighten yourself. Spook yourself. Because then the sense of self will appear vividly to you, and you'll see quickly, my sense of self does not appear to just depend upon my body and mind. It seems to have its own entityness. Are you looking to go, no, it doesn't look like it depends upon my body. It doesn't look like it's mine. In fact, it seems to be the owner of them. It's something else. It possesses them. That's what you want to find. Because when this eye pops out, when you shock it out, it really does not seem to be dependent upon your body or mind. It's something else. So you've got to find that and then sort of do that first with yourself, with your own body and mind, and then move it across to other objects. And of course, the other objects aren't like chairs and tables, even though you could do it with that. No, the object is you focus on your body, your feelings, your thoughts, everything. If anything within this continuum called me has any inherent existence whatsoever. Now, I'll tell you now, once you find this first one, like it's going to go like within a blink of an eye, oh my gosh, everything has lacks inherent existence. It follows very quickly. Nevertheless, you should still go back and run the whole analysis, right, to confirm it. So you see, like in the Heart Sutra, they say there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no body, no mind, no visual object. So this is what they're doing. They're investigating each object to see if it has inherent existence. So they're saying there's no inherently existent eye. There's no inherently existent ear. There's no inherently existent object of your ear. No sound, sight. None of these things has any inherent existence. So in the Heart Sutra, when it says no, 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 it means no inherently existent such and such. No inherently existent. And I always remember a time here when one of our students, bless her heart, said, this is ridiculous. Of course there are eyes and noses. So it's in our last meditation. Let's let your body rest in a calm and upright way. And create an altruistic intention to do this meditation. Okay, we wish to become enlightened to benefit all sentient beings. So So begin by recognizing that your friends, strangers you meet, and enemies are not that way from their own side. Therefore, balance social reactivity. And inspire solidarity by recognizing all beings as family. And remembering their kindness, be grateful. Reciprocate with affection, wishing to repay the kindness of family. And then inspire empathy by recognizing the sameness of yourself and others. Now, consider the disadvantages of egocentricity. And this will inspire renunciation and compassion. They generate a cherishing love by considering the advantages of cherishing others. And recognize that you can be courageous when exchanging self-preoccupation with cherishing others. And then inspire within yourself a great courageous compassion by taking others' sufferings and giving everything lovely. Inspire a selfless love. In taking responsibility for the welfare of all beings, adopt the wholehearted resolve, and with radical altruism, practice the affections to become a Buddha. I think this is the path for a being of great capacity. And inside yourself, I am that being. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. Okay, so what's our takeaway today? Well, hopefully, you know, the principles and capacities of people engaged in this path through these three scopes and the three principal aspects. So between now and the next time we have a class, find any material on the foundation of good qualities, have a quick squeeze at it. And if you can, memorize this. This prayer comes up again and again and again in the teachings. And if you can memorize it, it can really serve you well when you find yourself in particular situations. And so coming up, the next teaching we'll be engaging is the How to Rely Upon a Spiritual Mentor. So, towards the end of this class, we'll do our dedication prayers now, and we'll call it a night. So please join me in dedicating the merit that you've created by saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, that I quickly attain the state of a living Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, Bodhicitta, not be born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. And then the prayer for His Holiness's long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind thinking that so I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the prayer for the discovery and return of Rinpoche. In holding and spreading the moving's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that has never disparaged. incomparable Venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Okay. First, in this teaching, thank you very much for being here, engaging it, and thank you for your life.